Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer reporting from the Waihe coastal dunes and wetlands on the island of Maui. Come along and join me for a visit with Scott Fisher, Director of Land Stewardship, and Olu Campbell, CEO of Hawaiian Land Trust. Campbell explains Hawaii Land Trust protects the lands that sustain Hawaii and teaches future generations to do the same.
E ala ka I mai, e ki a I mai, e pō mai ka I mai e. E komo mai ka lai o nei aina, he aina ki pa aloha. Aloha e, aloha e, aloha e. Yeah, well, welcome. I just want to say how much we appreciate you coming out today. So, welcome to this place. Basically, it starts off by saying the winds that, you know, Hawaiians were very ma'a, very familiar with all of the environmental conditions. So, the first sentence starts off with the winds of the Kamakani Kili O'opu blow onto this land. Talks about that mountain right there. Mauna Alani is verdant and glimmering in the sunshine. Talks about the path that we'll be taking down that leads to Kealakai Honua and Kalai Ili'ili. Basically, it's a way of asking for guidance, protection, and also just wanting to welcome everybody. Probably the most enjoyable part of my job is to say that everybody who comes on this property is always welcome. As long as they are respectful, we want them to be on this land. Connecting people to land is one of the most important things we can do. This is Scott Fisher. I am the Director of Aina Stewardship, and we are at the Waihe'e Coastal Dunes and Wetlands Refuge in Waihe'e, Maui.
My name is Olu Campbell, President and CEO of Hawaii Land Trust.
Today we are at the Waihe'e Coastal Dunes and Wetlands Refuge, which is a 277-acre wildlife refuge, but also culturally very significant.
So this area we're standing on, this was agriculture for a period of time?
Okay, so the earliest evidence that we have of people actually living here goes back to about 950. One of the earliest sites on the island of Maui after human arrival. The area where we're standing here now is actually between 1919 and 1970, there was a what we call the plantation era, a dairy. So many people today still refer to this area as the old Waihe'e Dairy. The Land Trust purchased it in 2004. We started managing it in 2003, but when we purchased it in 2004, we did it with the intention of doing three things, and that was to do ecological restoration work, which is restoring the habitat for endangered species, specifically the structure, function, and composition of the ecosystems. The second thing we wanted to do was preserve and protect the numerous archaeological sites. So there's a total of 93 state-listed archaeological sites on the property. So we have to protect those. In some instances, we're actually restoring them back to their former glory. And the third thing we do is education at the Waihe'e Refuge. So we have between about 2,000 and 3,000 students that come out and learn. We have an amazing director of education. She will help teachers develop their curriculum that would fit this area. Education, recreation is kind of the two go together. So where we're standing right now is one of our most popular camping sites. So we encourage people to camp. We ask them to volunteer one time. So they kind of the hulina lima ika lepo, turn your hands into the soil and you have life. And so what we want to do is encourage people to participate. But once you participate, once you get out here and volunteer one time, you can camp out here.
This is rustic camping.
Yeah, not camping. Although, as we're going down here, there's actually a shower where people can shower. And there's a portable toilet that we keep on the site. But it's really great to see generations now. Now we're almost one generation into it. So we're seeing people who came as young children and now they're bringing their children, which is really exciting.
Cool. Let's go back in time 1,000 years.
Yes.
What was here? Who was here?
You know, we put a lot of effort into trying to reconstruct what the flora and the fauna of this area. That's been a big point of our work here, is to do that research. So where we're standing right now, if you were here, if you were arrived at the Waihe'e Refuge in 950, you would have been greeted by, first and foremost, a lot of birds. So when the first humans arrived on Maui, there were about 109 bird species. Sadly, we're reduced down to somewhere between 12 and 16. That's excluding seabirds, of course. But 109 terrestrial birds when people first arrived. As many of your listeners may know, Hawaii is the, what we call the extinction capital of the country. It's something that we want to try and at least arrest and try and reverse. So you've been greeted by a lot of birds. Right here, this seems to have been an area where there are a large number of what we call Lolu, they're fan palms. So the fan palms of in the genus Prichardia were hyper abundant. From some of my estimations of what we've looked at the pollen in the area, you probably could not have taken more than a few steps without bumping into one. But there would have been other diverse species, grasses and shrubs, but the fan palm would have dominated with a lot of birds. In fact, where we're actually standing right now, one tree, it's possibly indigenous, more likely to have been introduced by the first Polynesians to arrive. That's what we call the milo. Other than that, it's like a world tour of invasive species right now. So we have these grasses that are African grasses. That's a guinea grass is what we refer to it, Panicum maximum. We have Christmas berry, which is Shinus terebinthifolius. This here, Kiawe, which is a real common species along the coastal areas of Hawaii. That actually comes from the American Southwest. Prosopis pallida is the genus. Even coconut, you know, kind of the quintessential tree that people think was an early addition, but it was from Polynesia. It was brought in by the Polynesians. So Hawaii is today a mix of plants that have arrived between 950 and 1778, and then, of course, the indigenous and endemic species.
Some of the species that came in were accidental?
Most of the ones are accidental and intentional. So, for example, the guinea grass that I referred to earlier, that guinea grass was really used because cattle became important to the economy of the Hawaiian Islands. And so the guinea grass, Kiawe, was intentionally brought in by a gentleman on Oahu who missed it because he was from the American Southwest, Juan Pablo Francisco de Marin. It actually wasn't brought in by him, but he was the first one to plant it near his home on Oahu. But ranchers came to understand that the species was also a nitrogen fixer. There are relatively few nitrogen fixers along the coastal habitats of the Hawaiian Islands, and so that became a big boom because all of a sudden you have the grass that will grow up more quickly. It's something that came in almost accidentally or sentimentally, but then proliferated because of the changing economies. And so,
and the ohia?
Ohia is more often you find up in the upper areas, but it will really grow down to the coast.
Is that indigenous?
That is endemic, actually. Okay. Yeah, the ohia is kind of the quintessential native forest tree. I'm blanking on the genus name. Metrosideros, yes. Metrosideros, thank you.
Look over your shoulder on the mountaintop.
Yeah.
There's a forest. It almost looks like it was a plantation.
These are mostly Cook Island pine. Uh-huh. And Cook Island pine were brought in for a variety of reasons. The real proliferation of the Cook Island pine, so that's Araucaria columnaris. People like to use them to identify where their houses were. So you'd be driving around, it's like, oh, you just look for the real tall tree. Because you can see, the two trees that we're looking at are very tall. I would estimate they're probably 80 to 100 feet tall. Those were planted in 1941. Actually, let me qualify that. In 1941, we have a picture of it, and it's already about 6 feet tall. Uh-huh. So, you know, these are pushing 80 plus years, or they are over 80 years old now. So,
tell us a little bit, Hawaiian Land Trust.
Yeah, Hawaii Land Trust.
Why did it start? When did it start?
Yeah, so Hawaii Land Trust, our origin goes back to about 2011 when four land trusts merged. That was the Kauai Public Land Trust, the Maui Coastal Land Trust, the Oahu Land Trust, and the Hawaii Island Land Trust. So we merged and became the Hawaiian Islands Land Trust, and then we've recently changed the name back to more appropriate Hawaii Land Trust, just because we do represent all of Hawaii. We're a conservation organization, so we work across Kapai Aina, across the archipelago, about 22,000 acres protected in a combination of conservation easements and fee-owned land. This land that we're standing on right now was our first major purchase of the Maui Coastal Land Trust. As I mentioned, it's 277 acres. But since then, our portfolio has grown substantially. Some of the largest land holdings we have now are on Hawaii Island, and so things are really moving a lot there. But our mission is basically to protect the lands that sustain us.
Is it limited to purchasing land, or do you have like the Williamson Act where you can keep your land but you guarantee not to develop?
Exactly. Yeah, that's essentially what a conservation easement does. So we have in the past purchased conservation easements. That is one of our strategies to protect land. That's very rare. Most of the conservation easements have been donated. People love their land. They want to ensure that it is protected in perpetuity, and we actually are the ones that can do that.
Private owners retain ownership to their land and you become the steward.
Exactly. And we protect the conservation values. We ensure that those conservation values that are identified by the landowner are protected in perpetuity.
Give us an example.
Okay. So our single largest on Maui is about 11,700 acres on Ulupalakua Ranch. And so the ranch owner, the Erdman family, approached us in about, I think it was probably about 2007 or so, and we began that negotiation process. They wanted to be able to retain some activities. They're a working ranch. They wanted to make sure that their ranch could be perpetually used for that purpose. But obviously, development and the threat of development is a perpetual concern. And so what we want to do is ensure that ability to ranch is never obstructed. And so we drafted an easement that essentially says just that. We're not ranchers. We don't go out and actually do that work, but we ensure that the provisions of the conservation easement are upheld in perpetuity. We're out there very frequently or relatively frequently, but at least once a year we have to get boots on the ground around the property to make sure that those values are being upheld.
So the landowners, are there some limitations to what they can do agriculturally?
There are. It's unique to each conservation easement. So if they say, for example, we want it to be open pastures, then it has to be kept as open pastures and they can't convert it to, you know, forestry.
Scott pointed out, it's a case-by-case basis, and there are values that we identify in each case that we find are meaningful. Sometimes those values are ecological values. Sometimes they're different communal values. They can be cultural value, it can be agricultural value, and recreational value, other things, right? And so we'll figure out what's important for our community, what in that situation is going to help both our place and our people thrive, and we'll protect that. So that can continue to deliver positive outcomes for our people for generations to come, and it'll continue to make our place better for all of us, right?
So an inducement might be a place to bring kids on field trips, and one of the attractions might be its archaeological provenance.
As Scott said earlier, you know, we're a conservation organization. I think a lot of people very easily relate conservation organizations to the natural resources side. I think it's a little bit more difficult sometimes for people to understand that conservation work is actually social impact work as well. We really do care about making sure that our natural resources, our native species are happy and healthy, because it's, for one, it's the right thing to do. But secondly, it's because it's beneficial for our community. It's very easy for people to connect our work in conservation with making sure our native ecosystems and our plants and animals are happy and healthy because it's the right thing to do. But secondly, it's because it's important for the success of our people. And so, for example, the fact that we have a healthy native ecosystem ensures that there's less sedimentation that's running into our reefs, or it ensures that there's more water supply for our communities. And so there isn't a single major social issue in our community that we can't connect to conservation work and then the positive impact that conservation work can have, whether it be mental health, the availability of clean drinkable water, education, like physical health, all those things. There is a way for our work here in land work to benefit our community in all those ways.
And for true community benefit, field trips, bringing kids out here would be central to your mission.
You know, and when we think about it, we look back on our Native Hawaiian culture. One of the foundations of Native Hawaiian cultural practice is based on this reciprocal relationship between our people and our place, and recognizing that the well-being of one is completely dependent on the well-being of the other. And so for something like a field trip, we recognize that when we bring those kids out here, they're developing that reciprocal relationship with place. They develop a shared sense of values, a shared sense of community. They might not be Scott in the future doing this type of work on a day-to-day basis, right?
Yeah.
But they'll take those values, and if, say, they're working in tourism or they're working in real estate development, they'll still take that value set with them, and they'll make decisions in their personal lives that align with that value set. And that is beneficial across the board, right?
You've been doing this for a while, right?
Personally, I've been involved since February at the Hawaii Land Trust, so not that long.
Before that, you were doing
what? Yeah, I've been doing community impact work. I would describe as a general field of work for my whole professional career. And then just kind of taking that lens that I've brought in previous type of work and bringing it and applying it to the Land Trust, and kind of recognizing that the work that Scott's been doing here for the last 20 years now is both conservation work, but it's also work that benefits our community very broadly.
Lelo No'eau, just to kind of capitalize on what Ola is saying, the Lelo No'eau is Iola Ka'aina, Iola Mako Ne, and that is, you know, when the land thrives, all of us thrive.
You've been doing this long enough, and we were talking about educational outreach and field trips. You've been involved in those, right?
Yeah.
Long enough that some of the first kids were maybe elementary school, and they're now at UH.
Yep.
So you watched this whole evolution of awareness.
Exactly.
Tell us about some of the epiphanous moments. That's touching stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, well, I started here a month and a half before my daughter was born. And now she is actually at the University of Redlands in California getting a degree in environmental studies. And so she's working this summer as an intern. But I just have this really, really clear memory of the first time that she saw a monk seal. So there was a monk seal on the shoreline here. And we kind of, you know, obviously we have to keep our distance, but we could hide ourselves behind a log and we kind of stuck our head up. You know, we were about 50 feet away. But just this epiphanous moment. You know, there was this animal that, you know, I prepared her for. You know, other instances we sometimes have overnight activities, and to have the kids see a seabird for the first time, or more importantly, to hear their moaning calls. You know, they like, what is that? You know, sounds like reminiscent of a crying baby. And so many instances. I think one of the most gratifying was one of the students who was down here very early on. She was in, I believe it was late elementary or middle school, and she was walking along with her class and very engaging. And then about 10 or 15 years later, I saw her bringing her own kids down. So that, again, very gratifying to see that. And it's that continuity, what we can offer, because we offer perpetuity, protection and perpetuity. Not all of us as individuals will always be here, but we'll always have that sense of aloha aina that we can perpetuate to all of our employees, and then our staff actually shares that with others. So it's such a critical element.
Tell us a little bit more about where we're at here.
Yeah, sure.
Would kids from town come out?
Yeah. One thing about Waihe'e that is so incredible is that we say we're 20 minutes from 75% of all students on Maui. Because most people, of course, as you know, live within the Central Valley. You know, somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes, people can be on this property. So it's not a challenge for schools to come down. We have a great relationship with the school that's, as the crow flies, it's less than a quarter mile away. So they'll come walking down, some good exercise, and then they'll do their studies. If they want to study marine debris, the plastic accumulation, they can do that. If they want to study about endangered species or how plants evolve.
Do the kids become stewards after they've been here and get involved in ongoing projects?
Yeah, that would be definitely a goal. When we hire, our preference is to hire people who are typically born and raised on Maui, as I was, at least here. And so all of our staff on Maui now are what we call kama'aina, born and raised here, literally children of the land. And so that's a really exciting thing for all of us. We, you know, to be able to come back and share our aloha by, as I mentioned, hulina lima I kalepo, turning our hands into the soil.
And archaeological sites right where we're at.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, that's a long story. So as you can imagine, over 1,000 years of people being here, one of the earliest sites is down about 100 yards away. And that's an old village site. We refer to it as Niua. Niua is the site of a village. We know it from the legends. A chief by the name of Hu'apuhukaina lived there. So an archaeological dig in 1987, that's where they found the earliest site. So that's the earliest site that we found. But some of the more important features, we have a village in the opposite direction of the earlier place, so a second village, and that dates to about the mid-15th century, so about the 1450s or so.
And any guesstimates of population?
It's a good question. So I had a friend who was a demographer. Now he's a Central American specialist, but you can kind of get a sense of, just because the land that you're bounded by, and his estimate was around 300 could have comfortably lived here. Now, that's because space is limited, just in terms of how, in truth, the amount of resources here. Immediately behind that village on the Mauka side and the inland side is a fish pond that we're actually in the process of restoring that we can go down and take a look at. That fish pond is 7 acres and would have produced well in excess of 70,000 pounds of taro annually. So the limitation would have been a space available for people to comfortably live. Now, one thing to consider is that that population would have been practicing what's known as transhumance, that people move in and out depending on resource availability. So this is a chiefly village. So chiefly villages, typically chiefs would move from one chiefly village to another, you know, kind of moving around, whereas the commoners, what are known as the Maka'ainana, would typically move Mauka Makai. And so we have, again, evidence of all of that happening here.
Would this be seasonal or?
Seasonal based on resource needs and availability. So for example, summertime, the ocean tends to be calmer, so people would come down and harvest marine resources. Whereas wintertime, you have to tend your gardens, your what are known as your lo'ikalo, your taro patches. So that's where the family I'm referring to, they actually still have their taro lands. And so,
do you have UH students, archaeology students come
out?
Yes,
actually, we have two right now. They just drove by a little bit. We're doing a big project funded from the National Science Foundation. And what we're doing is, just to kind of give a brief summary of it, we are exploring the fish pond. We're looking at the microbial communities in those and relating them to particular farming techniques and methods. And it's a really innovative archaeological microbiology. I'm also doing a study on history of natural hazards in this area, particularly big storms and tsunamis. I'm also doing a study looking at how much sediment is collected by our taro patches, because as Olu pointed out, our taro patches, they function both as food producing areas but also as sediment retention basins. In some studies, one in Palau in particular, they found that 90% of the sediment that would otherwise be discharged into the ocean is captured by this by the taro patches, the lo'ikalo. So what we want to try and do is restore our taro patches so that our reefs are healthier. As Olu was pointing out, there's that symbiotic relationship. There's that relationship when the land benefits, we benefit.
Because probably indigenous people weren't aware of what they were doing.
It's a good question. It's not written, but there are lots of what we call mo'olelo that hint at, and not hint at, in fact, in some senses, are explicit about, you know, if you do this, you're going to see your lands thrive. And that's why the whole Ahupua'a system, I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with what's known as the Ahupua'a, but started on Oahu. A chief by the name of Ma'ili Kukahi became concerned about the degradation, particularly of the marine resources. So what he said is, look, we need to manage the land in wedge-shaped parcels, I guess is probably the most accurate way of describing it. And these wedge-shaped parcels, the apex is up at the mountain, and the widest point is actually out in the ocean. So they actually go out into the ocean into what's known in Hawaiian as the lipo. And so that high degree of management and ownership, like your ahupua'a had to be sustainable. The result was it solved the tragedy of the commons problem. That is, oftentimes resources are sometimes threatened because of the tragedy of the commons, that if I don't take something, someone else will, so I might as well help myself to it. You were required from a very early time to actually manage your resources properly so you and your ohana, your family, were well cared for. And you can actually see that archaeologically. There's been papers published that when that ahupua'a system was implemented, the shoreline rebounded to a state of real tremendous health. So another olelo no'iau, ikawa mamua kawa mahope, that to understand how we're going to live in the future, we need to look to the past. And so that's really kind of what's informing our work out here now.
That's really fascinating. It follows you probably camped out here before.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah.
All in fact, just recently.
Have you ever felt the spirits?
Oh, absolutely.
The, yeah.
It's that presence. Again, camping out here with my daughter one time, I woke up about 3 in the morning, and of course I hear laughing all around my tent, and I get up and my daughter is sleeping. So yes, all the time. In fact, and that's one of the most, and of course I'm a scientist, so I have to approach this scientifically, but it's that sense of presence that people, our kupuna, our ancestors, are still here. They're not gone. We have a very strong commitment to protecting what we call iwi kupuna, the ancestral remains. And that iwi kupuna are physically present here in abundance. And so we have to take that kuleana, that responsibility. So absolutely, yeah. This is Scott Fisher. I am the director of Aina Stewardship, and we are at the Waihe'e Coastal Dunes and Wetlands Refuge in Waihe'e, Maui. For more information, you can search our website, hilt.org, or our social media platforms.
Instagram and Facebook. My name is Olu Campbell, President and CEO of Hawaii Land Trust. Thank you so much for having us on the show. Really appreciate you coming out and bringing the family with you, and hope that we can stay in touch.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Really had a great time.
Cool. Me too. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the island of Maui. We'll see you here.
Thank you. Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.